This is EdUp Legal with your host, Deborah Solmore. She's an experienced higher education lawyer, most recently the general counsel for a system of nonprofit institutions, and she's going to be leading conversations about trending legal, regulatory, and compliance matters in higher education, with a focus on leaving out the legalese and making legal easy. Let's hear from your host, Deborah Solmore.
Welcome to the EdUp Experience Legal Podcast. I'm your host, Deborah Solmore. And today I'm excited to welcome my two guests, former colleagues, colleagues of mine from my former Skadden Arp days. So this is very exciting. Laura Flath and Amy Van Gelder, who are both partners in Skadden's litigation practice. Welcome. It's nice to have you.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks, Deb. Excited.
So we've had about 6 weeks now to sort of digest the Supreme Court's decision related to race-conscious admissions. And I've done two episodes so far where I've talked to the Dean of George Washington Law School and talked to the General Counsel at Governor State right after the decision came out. But I've sort of been noodling on what does the decision mean long-term? And you and your colleagues wrote a wonderful article called Potential Private Sector Implications of the Supreme Court's Affirmative Action Ruling, which after I digested it, I thought, oh, wait, I know them. I'm going to reach out and see if they'd be willing to come on the podcast and talk to me about it. So that is what we are generally going to focus on today, if that's okay.
Of course.
So talk to me a little bit about, you know, sort of your thoughts about the after effect of the decision and where you're seeing the decision play out.
Laura, do you want to start with the parts of the opinion that we think?
Yeah, happy to. Thanks, Deb. So recognizing that, you know, everyone's heard a lot about the decision, I think there are three angles of it that we've really focused on that could have implications for areas beyond higher education, certainly in higher education as well. But these are really, I think, the sort of three key takeaways that people are focused on in the aftermath. And just to say it, you know, Amy and I both represented UNC in the affirmative action litigation. So we're gonna be talking about obviously the implications. None of this relates to, you know, our inside knowledge from that, from a privilege perspective.
I feel like I'm back in my publicly traded company days where I had to say at a panel, everything I'm saying here is my personal opinions and does not reflect the opinions of my employer or our organization. So well said. And again,
yeah, it's, you know, we'll try to keep it not too lawyery, but those little qualifications, you just can't get a lawyer to not say them.
No, much needed. And I appreciate that. And we will certainly stay outside of the realm of your client representation.
Yeah, absolutely. But so turning to the decision, I think there are three areas that we've really kind of focused on and that we see already, and we'll definitely talk about this, you know, where they're starting to come into play. First, it's sort of a concept under the Supreme Court law called compelling interests. But really, when you're trying to come up with these goals, one of the things that the court was looking at was, are the interests that the universities put forth compelling under, you know, Supreme Court standards? But the court focused on the fact that the goals articulated by the universities, by both Harvard and UNC, were admirable, but were not sufficiently, this is a lawyer word, coherent in order to permit meaningful review by courts. So what does that really mean? The goals were things like training future leaders, adapting to an increasingly pluralistic society, broadening and refining understanding, fostering innovation. So even though the court said those are commendable and worthy, they were not specific enough where the court said, ah, I can evaluate that. So for example, how do you measure the robust exchange of ideas? How can courts know when a goal has been reached and when using a preference based on race can end? Between that and then also, you know, what are the means that you're using? How are you getting there and the goals pursued? Does an assignment of a candidate to a racial group help further the benefits? And is it articulated enough and sort of measurable enough that a court can look at it and really assess those questions? So we'll talk about sort of the implications of that, but I think it's important to keep in mind when thinking about goals of programming, especially in the DEI space. The second area that's really been focused on is sort of the, you know, what we call the twin commands of the Equal Protection Clause. But race is not supposed to be used as a negative and it cannot operate as a stereotype. Now, previously, under the Supreme Court, you'd really seen courts be able, you know, permit the use of race as a plus factor. But here, the court really focused in on the zero-sum nature of an admissions decision outcome. Because someone gets admitted, that necessarily means someone else does not. And by providing a benefit to some applicants, but not to others, that's necessarily going to advantage the former group at the expense of the latter.
I think you refer to it in your article as the binary outcome, right?
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so that's really an area that, even though the opinion is limited to the context of higher education and you're under Title VI, we're already seeing folks start to invoke that in sort of this binary outcome, the zero sum, someone wins, someone loses, even if it's not the one, you know, you're saying, oh, we're not using this as a negative. If you're not an underrepresented minority, in fact, that necessarily and inherently is going to create that issue. The other place where I think that the program, you know, the court really noticed this too, is that a lot of these programs for UNC and Harvard, there was not a logical endpoint, as the court put it. So there was no point at which you would say, okay, we've reached the end of when we have to consider race. That's certainly a big piece, and I think you're going to continue to see a lot of focus on that. You know, I think the final piece that we focused on is that people, you know, you've already started to see it in higher ed, the sort of last paragraph of, we're not saying you have to be race blind. You can, in fact, be race conscious when it comes to a particular individual applicant, if they're talking about race and how it's impacted their life in a particular way as tied to a specific goal, a non-racial goal being pursued by university. So, for example, my heritage influenced my desire to get into leadership and student politics and government, and therefore you're sort of talking about your racial ethnicity in the context of another characteristic like leadership, grit, overcoming adversity. But, you know, so folks sort of, I think, saw that and went, okay, there's a way to work around. The court cautioned, you can't use that as a workaround to try to sort of implement the regime that they held unlawful. So those, I think, are really the three areas where we're seeing attention come out of the decision and sort of starting to implicate, you know, other areas beyond higher ed.
Go ahead, Amy.
I think the last statement caused probably the most confusion. Mm-hmm. And the way that I interpreted it was, you actually can't consider race, but you can be cognizant of someone's race. And then what you should be crediting is their grit, their inspiration, their determination. And so it'll be interesting to see how, I think there's going to be a lot of attention paid to how people implement that in practice.
And I think there was that sort of glimmer of hope, but wait. I think I saw an article within the last few days that gave examples of how certain institutions have changed the essay or rewrote the essay. And so it'll be interesting to see kind of where that goes next.
Yeah, absolutely, Deb. And I think you're already starting to see that, you know, the organizations that brought the suits against Harvard and UNC are paying close attention. They're watching for that. And I think, you know, whether it's sending letters or putting points out there, I think it will be the subject of attention. And I think it's, you know, a lot of it's going to come down to sort of implementation.
So I think you do a great job of sort of explaining these three buckets. You know, I always like to say the Supreme Court generally will answer one question. Maybe they'll answer one question. But regardless of what question they answer, they certainly leave, you know, a whole bunch more questions unanswered. And so, you know, where are you seeing the unanswered questions from the decision? I mean, I know there's been a lot out there about how institutions are looking at this next admission cycle, but it goes beyond college admissions, right? It's taking on a whole sort of another life of its own. So where are you seeing it play out in other areas?
Yeah, Amy, why don't you take this one and we can talk a little bit about the distinction between higher ed and, of course, our other Title VII landscape.
Sure. So I think the big question for the private sector is, how does this decision apply to me, if at all? And what we've, you know, really, this decision is under Title VI. That does not apply to private sector. Gorsuch, of course, in his concurrence, hinted that Title VI, which is what applied to the universities, the law that applied to the universities, sits next door to Title VII, which is the law that applies to employers. So that, I think, perked the interest of employers, perked the interest of activist groups and organizations that might be out there policing the private sector. And I think much of the commentary and concern has come with DEI initiatives, which of course are things that, you know, in the aftermath of George Floyd and other things that really have picked up in the private sector. And there's really been a conscientious effort to improve upon DEI initiatives in the private sector. And this zero-sum nature of the admissions decision, I think there's some concern could apply to other benefits that are applied in the employment situation. But of course, nothing changed about employment law. And the EEOC chair has said, you know, DEI policies remain lawful after this decision. This decision did not address DEI policies. So it's been interesting to watch, but both Republican attorney generals have sent some warning letters to the Fortune 100 saying, hey, you have these policies in place. You might be violating the law here. We think you're violating the law. The court has made clear that, you know, there any sort of discrimination is not legal in the United States. Then we saw the Democratic AGs come out with a rejoinder a week or so later saying, you know, nothing has changed about the law that applies to the private sector. And what you were doing is legal and it remains legal. We've seen Senator Cotton warn the law firms that potentially, you know, pay attention to the DEI policies that you have in place. And we've seen organizations like Stephen Miller's organization, America First Legal, which was issuing these types of complaints and letters even before the SSFA decision, ratchet up their kind of warnings to the public. So I think that everyone is focused on, is there some litigation risk with the way that we're implementing our DEI policies and initiatives? Of course, you can't consider race in hiring decisions. That's illegal in the United States under only very discrete exceptions to that. And companies shouldn't be doing that. But when it comes to DEI, there's certainly programs and initiatives that are in place that might benefit certain racial groups and might be designed to enhance a pipeline of diverse candidates or enhance access to employment opportunities by diverse candidates. And I think that's coming under scrutiny at this point.
Just to build on that, I mean, Amy made, I think, the really interesting point, which is that people are really focused on this now, exactly as you said, Deb, right? In the 6 weeks since the decision, what has happened? Has this changed things? But a part of this movement was already out there. Some of those letters were being sent out to companies and publicly announced, like these are on the websites of, you know, these organizations, National Center for Public Policy Research, America First, different organizations that are out there sort of calling themselves think tanks or otherwise, sending letters saying, we think this is wrong, we think you have an issue. And it's really a shift from where we were seeing things in say 2020, 2021, when these initiatives were being announced. You then actually saw groups sort of saying, you're not doing enough. That's great, you've put out a policy. Are you really implementing it? So this was already starting to be a little bit of a backswing. And I think where they're seizing on is some of the language that we've now seen from the opinion that we talked about as, if they can get it in front of a court, are they going to be, is there a more receptive audience? Can they use this now to help push that, in fact, even though this was Title VI, if faced with this question, you should be interpreting it the same way as SFFA did. I think that's where you're going to sort of start to see those potential challenges, but, you know, the same defenses in that context as before.
And I think, as you know, when I think about my role as a general counsel, and I think about all of our general counsels who are trying to advise sort of their organizations, I kind of keep coming back to this risk tolerance idea or risk mitigation. And as I'm sure you're counseling, you know, your clients, there's kind of like this spectrum. Do you want to be on the forefront of pushing your initiatives and, you know, sort of maybe standing up for what you believe in with this risk? I think I read somewhere in some article, somebody called it the coming of the litigative haze. I don't know if litigative is actually a word, but it was a kind of nice, you know, it's kind of a nice quote. Or do you want to sort of stay in the background and not be the ones that wind up getting sued? And so I think before guiding or advising organizations, you can do this, you can't do this, you should do this, you shouldn't do that, people are going to really have to start taking a hard look, right, at where do you want to be on that spectrum? Because, you know, a lot of what I know what I do as in a role as a general counsel is counsel on risk and try to help my clients figure out what they want to do based on what their risk tolerance is.
That's so right. And I think that's where folks are struggling. You know, the question, you know, practical guidance, what can I do? What's mm-hmm. permissible? It's one of those moments when I think you're at a point sometimes going, well, it depends. We don't know exactly. And that's such an unsatisfying answer to be giving. But I think right now we're just going to sort of have to see in many ways how it develops. And to your point, where are you, you know, can you look at your policies? How are they actually being implemented? Those types of pieces with, again, and, you know, Amy alluded to this, right? Focusing in on perhaps some of the places where we're starting to see those indications, the binary outcomes, places mm-hmm. where you sort of got numerical thresholds. Those have always been places where, you know, litigants, even, you know, the SFFA place, we're focusing, right? Like, are you using a quota? Because that hasn't been permissible for a very long time. Like, that was not the change, right? Quotas were not acceptable, either in higher ed or otherwise, unless under really specific circumstances for like a remediation type issue. But has it sort of, has something evolved towards that where you're using that language or that's been sort of how you're seeing it? Is that a place to look at to say, okay, are we really, you know, complying with the law as we understand it, which has not changed?
I think you also, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think companies are struggling with the push and pull of this because mm-hmm. they've determined that DEI is a valid business interest, not only ethically, but economically. It's supporting their business. And so to pull away from some of the initiatives that they have determined are economically advantageous to a business is difficult. And then they face scrutiny from those investors or shareholders that do support DEI, saying, hey, you're pulling back from something that's important to the company and trying to be hyper compliant almost out of fear to some language that's in a decision that doesn't apply to us. And then on the other side of the aisle, you have the risk of scrutiny or potential litigation for those types of organizations that want to expand the law beyond the higher education setting. And so there is kind of a push-pull. And I think that organizations, you know, there's no need to be hyper compliant, but there is a need to potentially mitigate the statements that are out there to convey that they're implemented by the company in compliance with the law that applies to that company. That's dependent on the state that they're in, and that's dependent on what type of policy it is. But having a close look at that and making sure not only is the policy in line with the law, but the implementation in line with the law, I think is something that private sector is looking at.
So kind of two thoughts from that. And I think you hit on sort of one of my, I guess, soapbox issues, which is what does a policy say, just generally any policy, and how do you implement it? Because an organization is better off having no policy at all than having a written policy that they don't follow. And so I think, you know, whenever I have an opportunity to sort of remind people of that, I like to. So thanks for bringing that up. The other thing I'm thinking, and I don't know if you're seeing this yet or your counseling clients on this as well, is these decisions that we're talking about, sort of where your risk tolerance is, where you want to be hyper compliant, where you want to sort of, you know, make your own interpretations. I think, Amy, you said it well, of something that a decision that didn't necessarily apply to these other avenues is board involvement, right? So, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, the role of a board of directors or a board of trustees in the higher education space to sort of stay out of the day-to-day management of the organization, you know, hire and fire the president, really be up there in the strategic 30,000 foot. But what I'm seeing is this is probably one of those areas where you're really going to get a lot of thought leadership and conversations at the board level as to sort of where does an organization, whether it be in higher ed or corporate America, you know, private company, public company, take this. So I don't know if you're sort of counseling boards on that or you're seeing more board involvement than before the decision.
I think too early to tell, Deb, on a sort of a general high level at that point. And I think a lot of it's really going to depend, and sort of to Amy's point about being company specific, right, or institution specific. You know, some act faster than others. Some are taking some time to digest this. And I think it's really, I think it will continue to evolve. I think it will continue to be, you're right, it's going to be a point of discussion and focus. But then just sort of depends too on what role that board, whether, you know, or trustees play on a normal basis, right? I mean, there are levels of involvement, yes, right? As you said, hire and fire, there are some that are down dirtier in the weeds. You know, where is it all gonna fall? I think it's too early to say, are we seeing, you know, real reportable trends at this point?
I saw an article the other day about the same organization. Well, I guess they have a different name for this organization, but same person behind the Student Fair Housing case, a student for fair admission case, has now filed a lawsuit in Atlanta against an organization sort of challenging a program that they have, their Fearless Fund. And so it's really the first thing I read about where there's been a lawsuit filed that's really outside of higher ed. I don't know if I realize it's just a complaint that's been filed, nothing's happened, but I don't know if you have any initial thoughts about that, or, you know, sort of think it's, you know, the start of a trend of more litigation to come.
I mean, from my perspective, I think it's the start of a trend. And Ed Blum, the backer of, right, Students for Fair Admission, and now American Alliance for Equal Rights, has said publicly that this is essentially the beginning of the end of what he perceives as race-based discrimination. So I think he and others like him, and I think I mentioned America First Legal, which is Stephen Miller's organization, they are organizations in search of plaintiffs or in search of standing to challenge these laws. And for your non-legal listeners, it means they're looking for a way to get in front of the court and challenge the activities of organizations like Fearless, which are, you know, offering grants to, I believe it's minority-owned, Black women-owned businesses, right, saying that invoking a pretty arcane law about contracting that was put in place after the Civil War. So it's a Civil War era law that they're invoking to say, you know, you can't discriminate, your program needs to be open to people of all races. And they're going to kind of continue to seek to challenge these types of initiatives and hope to bring it up to the current 6-3 court and see if they can get traction to expand the thinking into other areas.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think, you know, that law that Amy mentioned, sort of, I think it's like 1866, it's been invoked in other suits already too. I think Amazon faced some challenges with it, Comcast faced some challenges with it. So a little bit different. I mean, I think it's sort of implementation. And again, what's going to end up happening? Do courts actually rule on this? Do companies change policies? Do they defend it? All to be determined. But, you know, Ed Blum has been behind a number of suits. I mean, voting rights had been one of his issues beforehand. And as Amy said, he's actively out there saying, we want to challenge that. I believe he was behind some of the board diversity challenges, even in California too. So there's a lot of different avenues that are out there already being litigated, being investigated. He's also looking for, they've got a website now out for plaintiffs for West Point. So there had been an exception in the Supreme Court's decision, correct, about the, yeah, military academies. That's going to be, you know, your next angle. Which one holds, which one catches, I think to be determined, right? We sometimes see the starts of waves and then it's like, you know, a smaller little one, it's a tidal wave versus like the massive crashing one.
Yeah, so much to follow. I mean, we could spend a whole day talking about this. Any sort of final thoughts or any sort of, you know, I don't know, maybe best practices or guidelines or tips that, you know, you kind of want to throw out there to our listeners as we kind of work through these issues, both in higher ed and I agree with you, what's probably coming in the private sector as well?
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, I think that at least in the private sector, and this probably applies to universities as well, is to really examine the goals that you're trying to achieve. You know, take a look at them and make sure that your statements are, that your public facing statements and the policies that you're implementing internally are supporting the goals that you're trying to achieve in a concrete way, that one is connected to the other. And tailor those policies to the goals that you're trying to achieve. Of course, you know, consult with your lawyers, consult with your employment lawyers to make sure that you're following the letter of the law in putting together your DEI policies and initiatives and your hiring practices, of course. But if you have clear statements and are thinking about your goals in a good way and documenting that well, then you'll be, I think, well positioned to weather the storm of a challenge if one arises.
I would just add, I agree with everything Amy just said. I think being thoughtful about your process is important. I think there it's a natural instinct as soon as you see this decision and go, okay, what does it do? What do we have to do right away? I do think being thoughtful, thinking about a process, giving some intentionality to that in addition to the goals of your organization, but like, how are you gonna get there? What's the process? How do you go through all of those stages too? I think it's an important time. We echo, call your legal departments, call your lawyers, promise they're here to help you, not to hurt. But that would be the other piece.
I love that message.
Figured you'd like that one, Deb.
I love right that here. Message. You have to sometimes remind that. But I think, you know, I think your advice is great because not everything can be solved with a very quick, oh, let's put out a statement or, you know, we'll sit in the background and watch. I think intentionality and purpose. And you echo, whenever someone comes to me with a problem, one of the first things I always think is, what is the problem we're trying to solve for? And let's like really nail that down. And I think that aligns perfectly, Amy, with what you said about figure out what your goals are. And once you know what your goals are, you'll be able to work them. I can't thank you guys enough. It's great to, I know nobody else is going to see you visually, but for me, it's wonderful to see you on video. It's been a while. And, you know, thank you again. This has been like very enlightening and you guys always have such great insight. And I will post the article. I posted it to my LinkedIn because I thought it was so wonderful, but I will post it in our show notes. And I hope you'll come back and chat with us again soon.
Yeah, we'd love to. This was fun. Thanks for having us, Deb.
You're very, very welcome.
Thank you so much, Deb.